Welcome back to a special edition of Midday. I'm Bridget Armstrong, filling in for Tom Hall. We won't be taking your calls today, but you are welcome to visit WYPR's Facebook page and leave your comments. Now I turn to a woman who writes about flawed women, women who are broken, women who won't bow to a man's will, women who make mistakes, women who challenge the status quo, women who are just trying to figure it all out, women who are difficult. Roxane Gay's latest collection of short stories explores what it means to be a difficult woman. Roxane Gay is a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times. She's the author of several books, including the New York Times bestseller, Bad Feminist, and her latest, Difficult Women. And Roxane joins me now from Lafayette, Indiana. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So difficult women, that's a term that means a lot. Usually when people say it, it's negative. And I love in the book how you explore the different ways that difficult manifests and what is usually behind that, what it really means. Who are the women in this book? What are their characters? What have they gone through? What makes them difficult?
The women in these stories are generally considered difficult because they have opinions or they dare to stand up for themselves or they have unruly emotions after being put in impossible situations.
In the dedication to the book, you say this is for difficult women who should be celebrated for their very nature. I'm wondering if you mind reading a passage from the book. It's from a story that's titled Difficult Women. The part I'm interested in is what a crazy woman thinks when she walks down the street.
What a crazy woman thinks about while walking down the street. She tries to walk, not too fast and not too slow. She doesn't want to attract any attention. She pretends she doesn't hear the whistles and the catcalls and lewd comments. Sometimes she forgets and leaves her house in a skirt or a tank top because it's a warm day and she wants to feel warm air on her bare skin. Before long, she remembers. She keeps her keys in her hand, three of them held between her fingers like a dull claw. She makes eye contact only when necessary, and if a man should catch her eye, she juts her chin forward, makes sure the line of her jaw is strong. When she leaves work or the bar late, she calls a car service, and when the car pulls up to her building, she quickly scans the street to make sure it's safe to walk the short distance from the curb to the door. She once told a boyfriend about these considerations, and he said, "You are completely out of your mind." She told a new friend at work, and she said, "Honey, you're not crazy. You're a woman."
Thank you. I love that part of that story. Mainly because sometimes as women, as minorities, you have to kind of live with this double consciousness. It's what you want versus these outside factors. And this woman in this story is told that, you know, she's crazy. And then she has to be later, I guess, another woman has to basically support her and support these ideas to help her understand what she's going through. Could you talk about sort of the motivation for that and this idea of trying to be a woman who is likable, or a woman who, you know, doesn't expect the worst, but also a woman who keeps herself safe and who understands the world around her?
You know, I think that women have long had to possess double consciousness, where we know what it's really like to be women, and we also have to contend with what people don't know about what it means to be a woman. And people of color, of course, also endure this. Queer people do. And so in the title story in particular, I really send up a lot of the tropes that women face, the ways in which we're labeled crazy or difficult or loose or just really any sort of term that diminishes the realities of who we are.
And your first story in the book, It's a hard story, and it's called I Will Follow You. It's about two sisters who, because of a shared childhood trauma, become inseparable. Could you talk about writing that book and talk about the ways in which trauma can manifest for women and have them read as difficult or any other sort of negative stereotype?
Yeah, in the story I Will Follow You, I was really interested in what would happen between two sisters who are kidnapped and go through something really horrible? What would that do to their bond? And in that story, the two sisters are really inseparable because they know why they are the way they are. They know what they've been through. And people in their lives might think of them as insular and difficult, but they know that they are just doing the best they can in the aftermath. The thing about trauma is that it's messy and that there is no neat and well-contained trajectory toward healing. And sometimes you're never fully healed. And so oftentimes as women endure trauma and then try to overcome it, and really women, men, and people who are somewhere in between on the gender spectrum, you know, there is just no set way in which we recover. And so that makes us difficult. And that's a really interesting place for me to explore as a writer.
A lot of the women in the book are trying to figure it out and sort of find a place of happiness or wholeness. And not all the stories in the book sort of end in a sad way or only deal with trauma. There are women who may be flawed, maybe trying to figure it out, but also find love or find a sense of worth throughout the book. Essentially, the idea that even if, you know, you've gone through these traumas or that you are difficult, that you are still deserving of some sort of happiness, and why it was important to put that also in the book.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I tend to write dark stories, but you'll notice that in almost every story, there is something
a thread of happiness. Hope. Yeah.
Because I think that you can't have darkness without light, and there has to be light. Otherwise, what are you asking the reader to really engage in as they follow you through a story? And so I'm very much interested in also writing about happiness and love and joy and what it takes to really be able to be loved and to be happy.
And how much, when you were writing this book, did you reflect on your own experiences and put them into the characters?
Not much. You know, fiction is fiction. And so I do draw from things in my life. So, for example, I lived in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, and just the natural landscape and the remote setting helped inform, for example, my story North Country or the story How. But I always make sure, no matter what I take from my life, that the stories I'm writing are fiction, because it's important for fiction to be fiction.
Right. Speaking of fiction and writing and putting yourself into the book, you are writing a memoir about yourself called Hunger that's coming out in June. It's about food. It's about weight. It's about body image. As a person who writes essays, writes your observations, and then also writes fiction, what was it like to write about yourself?
It was difficult. It's certainly... Hunger has been the most difficult book I've ever written and will probably be the most difficult book I ever write. It was very difficult, which I know is not, it's just, I expected it to be easier because it's myself and I know myself, but I'm really, this is a memoir of my body and it's a book about trauma and obesity. And even though when you're overweight, your body is a public text and people project onto you all sorts of things and ideas about how you got that way and what it means for your body to be overweight, it's another thing to put that story in my own words and to really examine myself. And so it's been challenging.
And so what is it, and without, of course, giving too much away from the book, Away for Hunger, what inspired you? What made you want to write about your own experiences? Was it something that was sort of therapeutic for you? Was it something so other women could also identify with your experiences? What kind of propelled you to do that?
I don't know if it was therapeutic for me, even though it has been really helpful for me to just take a look at some of the patterns I've been repeating for more than 20 years now. But I know that there are very specific narratives about bodies and weight, and they generally involve weight loss. And I read a lot of these books with interest, as if I might find the answer to what it means or what it takes to lose weight. And I thought about my own life and how I'm not there yet, but I very much would like to be, but we never really hear from people in an extended way about what it means to be fat in this world that is very inhospitable to fat people. And so I decided to write that book about what it means to be fat in the here and now.
Your collection of essays, Bad Feminist, was published in 2014, and you explored all the different ways, and you explored a lot of, you know, media and pop culture, but you also explored a lot of all of the different ways that a woman could be a feminist. I'm wondering, since the publishing of that book, since, you know, Beyonce has been declared a feminist, since we've had all these different definitions of what a feminist can be, do you think that people's idea of feminism is evolving in any way? Are women allowed to be feminists and be other things as well?
Yes and no. I mean, of course, women are allowed to be feminists. And I do think that we are getting a more expansive understanding of feminism, but there's so much work to be done. There are so many people who still think that feminism means man-hating and who have very shallow, narrow understandings of what feminism is and does. That said, when a star like Beyonce comes out and declares that she's a feminist, it does a lot of work. It goes a long way, and it opens a gateway for people to learn more about feminism. It's certainly not the end of the journey, but it is the beginning for many people, and I think that's wonderful.
And in a lot of ways, I mean, even when we talk about someone like Beyonce, she's been accused of exercising feminism light, if you will. Recently, we heard writer Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie talk about feminism light. She has a little bit of a different definition of that. And I wonder what your thoughts are on that. You talk a lot about feminists being allowed to listen to music that may not be, you know, becoming to women, or, you know, feeling sexual or expressing those ideas and it not necessarily being at odds with their feminism. So I'm just wondering what's your opinion on the criticisms of, or the idea that the wave of feminism that we're dealing with now is feminism light.
Oh, I think that's utter nonsense. I really do. I think that we spend too much time in contemporary feminism, like grading each other and grading feminism instead of doing the actual work of feminism. You know, we can't judge Beyonce's feminism only on her public persona. You know, she knows what kind of feminist she is. And so it's not up to me to say whether she's a good or feminist or a bad feminist. But I also know that feminism and, for example, sexuality, they're not opposites. They're not antithetical to one another. And so one can be sexual and a feminist at the very same time. And it's important to keep pushing that. And it's important to recognize that there are people who practice feminism light, absolutely. But is that the majority of what's happening in contemporary feminism? No.
And I want to ask you a question, and I hope it's not too cliche, but I'm wondering, what do you see, what's your definition of feminism? And it's something that works for real women.
You know, I think that feminism is about equity and equality across gender lines. It's about ensuring that women have access to reproductive freedom and equal pay and the right to be free from violence. And it's really just about ensuring that women are enjoying lives that are as unfettered as men.
And one of the things that you've also written about is the separation between women of color, trans women, and white heterosexual women within feminism. This is something that's been going on since the days of Sojourner Truth, and it's something that's going on now. It's something we saw with the Women's March. Although there was a lot of diversity and inclusion within it, there were a lot of Black women who felt like it was not a movement for them, or that white women were now galvanized because of Trump's election, but were not particularly interested in the rights for women of color or trans women. I'm wondering what you see as the role for women of color and trans women within feminism, particularly in this movement and in this political climate, where I feel like sometimes a lot of the nuance is lost because, you know, everyone has kind of jumped to their sides, so to speak.
You know, I think that it's very difficult for many women of color and Black women in particular to feel welcome within feminism. And that's historical and entirely justified. And the same goes for queer women, trans women, working class women, women with disabilities, the list goes on when we look at who has been neglected by feminism. But, you know, the role that we have is the role that we decide to take and the role that we decide to establish for ourselves. We don't have to wait for anyone to anoint us with the right to participate in feminism. And I think it's very important for vulnerable women and marginalized women to remember that. We get to be the leaders that we want to see within feminism.
I'm wondering, who were some of your early writing inspirations, women in particular? Of course, I'm sure you're inspiring a lot of people now, but I'm wondering, who were you reading when you were younger? Even some of your favorite writers now.
You know, when I was younger, I just read everything I could get my hands on. So I read everything and anything, and I grew up in Nebraska, so, you know, I don't know that I had the most diverse reading. My favorite books growing up, and I'm still very fond of them, were the Little House on the Prairie books by Laura Ingalls Wilder, and I was also a big fan of Edith Wharton. When I got older and I started to discover Black women writers, I loved Alice Walker and, of course, Toni Morrison. Today, I'm a big fan of Zadie Smith, and I really think that right now is just a grand time for writing, and so I'm just enjoying a lot of what's coming out. Last year, The Mothers by Britt Bennett was just astounding, and so was Homegoing by Yag Yossi. And this year, I'm really looking forward to a book called Made for Love by Alyssa Nutting. So I love reading.
Okay, and I want to talk about a speech that you gave in the vein of, while we're talking about writers and women writers, a speech you gave at the Winter Institute in January, where you talked about the need for diversity in publishing. And one of the things you started with was how tired you are about talking about diversity. And I know that's something that a lot of people who are champions of diversity, people of color, have felt like. So first, could you talk about that idea of constantly talking about diversity and having the conversation, and how that conversation sometimes never translates to actual diversity? And then can we talk about why more diversity is needed in publishing?
You know, I'm just tired of talking about diversity because that's oftentimes the number one thing I'm asked to speak on, as if, as a Black woman, the only thing I can talk about is marginalization. And that's ridiculous. I can talk about a number of things. And diversity is, quite frankly, the least of my interests. And so it's just frustrating and it's exhausting because nothing ever changes. People think that by saying the word diversity, they're magically creating change or they're being progressive, and they're not. They're actually being very regressive because change requires commitment, and oftentimes it requires financial support. And most people and organizations are unwilling to do so. But it's also important. As tired as I am, I have the privilege of being tired of talking about diversity. The reality is that we need to keep beating this drum until things not only change, but stay improved. And it's important because we just need to hear from more voices. We need more people to be able to see themselves represented in popular culture and literature and art and film. So, you know, I'm exhausted with diversity, but I'm not done either. There's so much work yet to do.
Roxane Gay is a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times. She's the author of several books, including her latest, Difficult Women. Her forthcoming memoir, Hunger, will be released in June. For more information about Roxane's writing, please visit us on the web at wypr.org/midday. Coming up on the program tomorrow, guest host Kathleen Cahill speaks with Mary Elena Hincapie, the executive director of the National Immigration Law Center, and Bill Frelick of Human Rights Watch, about the global refugee crisis. Thank you to The Diz for supplying lunch today for our guests. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington and features signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served on weekends. You can visit them on the web at www.thedizbaltimore.com. That's it for us today. Thanks for listening to this midday special edition. I'm Bridget Armstrong, filling in for Tom Hall. More tomorrow.